Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This is the 100th episode of the show, and we're recording it starting at, it's March 8th, 2017 at 10:59 p.m. in Denver, Colorado. As I said, this is the 100th episode of the show. It's going to be a Q&A episode, and joining me are Lisa Scheim and Patrick Watson. Hey guys, welcome back to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Patrick, it's been a few months since we last chatted. When did we last chat? Was it in right before the election?
I think so. It was a recap of everything we knew about Hillary's birth time.
Right. That was good times, and all of that went well, and everything was happily ever after. And then Lisa, you were on not that long. When were you on last? I guess we did the electional episode last. What was the previous? Was it like the last Q&A, or what was the last full episode you were on?
You know, I'm not even sure. Maybe Saturn and Sagittarius roundup?
No, I mean, because we did the Q&A with Kelly in June last year. But yeah, that Saturn and Sagittarius we were all on. And how about that episode? Are you guys, I'm still constantly... You know, that's one of my favorite retrospective, like, forecast episodes that I've done, just because of how well that's worked out in a, you know, in a largely terrible ways, but in ways that were very much fitting with lots of the things that we talked about in that episode together, right?
Yeah, definitely. And really, like, even more striking than expected ways and sometimes with some things.
Right. All right. Well, this is the 100th episode. I've been doing the show since, 2012? I think I started in June. And somehow we reached 100 episodes, which is just really wild and really crazy. So I was thinking of different options. I almost did like a best of episode in order to play different clips. But I decided instead to do a Q&A episode so that we could actually get some interaction from the audience and from some of our hardcore listeners of the show. So I sent out a call for questions that people or discussion topics that people are interested in hearing about. To patrons of the show, and a bunch of patrons of the show in the past 24 hours sent in a bunch of questions. They were all really great questions. Unfortunately, there were so many, I was a little caught off guard by how many questions we got. So we're going to do some of them in this episode, and then we'll probably have to save some for another Q&A episode, you know, probably next month or something like that. Let's see, before we get started, a few points of business first. So our giveaway of this, of course, this month, the main prize that we're giving away is a free pass to the upcoming retreat that's being organized by the Organization for Professional Astrology. The retreat is taking place October 19th through the 22nd, 2017, in the mesmerizing Zion National Park in Utah. So OPA retreats are sort of a unique format. I led an OPA retreat, or at least I was a track leader on one a couple years ago. And it's kind of a unique format for studying astrology very intensely over a course of a few days, but also doing peer group work and working in small groups with, I think the maximum is something like 10 or 12 astrologers in a group, focusing on specific topics or focusing sometimes on specific techniques or approaches or things like that. So participants to the OPA retreat choose a track of study. And for 3 days, they're with the same mentor in a group that has a maximum of 10 participants for a deeper and more intimate learning experience. Additionally, all the tracks come together to attend short lectures, sort of in between some of the main lectures that they're focused on in their individual tracks. The theme of the retreat is the art of living and dying, celebrating the ingress of Jupiter into Scorpio, and also a sort of side theme of astronomy for astrologers. So out of 13 tracks, 5 of them are already sold out because, of course, there's a maximum of 10 people who can attend each track. So they actually get filled up. So if you're interested in signing up for the retreat, then you should look into it soon and you can book secure your spot in the track of your choice. So you can find out more information at opaastrology.org. At the end of March, on the forecast episode, we're going to be giving away a free pass to that to one lucky patron on the $10 tier as one of the perks for supporting the show. On the $5 tier, of course, we're giving away a signed copy of my new awesome book, which everybody has already heard about, called Hellenistic Astrology, The Study of Fate and Fortune. And the book is amazing. It covers the history, philosophy, and techniques of ancient astrology. And I'm going to send out, I'm going to do at least one signed copy, possibly pull two signed copies to send out to two lucky patrons on the $5 tier. I've started actually, Lisa's very excited because I have about 130 copies of the book showing up to our house tomorrow afternoon, right, Lisa?
Yeah, we have boxes everywhere. Hopefully we'll have some pictures soon.
Yes, we'll have some pictures of both of us looking very enthusiastic in a large fort of books that we're planning on building over the course of the next few days. So I'm starting to, after some snafus with like figuring out shipping and stuff last month, realize that I need to have a good 100 books on hand at any one time and to ship them out via USPS two-day priority mail. And that also allows me to sign the books now. So people that want the book signed, if you live in the U.S., just let me know when you order it and I'll send you a signed copy, which since it's the first edition actually could be valuable someday, since I'll probably do a second edition sometime later this year once I figure out how many little things there are that I want to change and fix. All right, so that'll be the prize for the $5 tier and we'll announce the winners at the end of the month. So let's get started with the actual discussion and the Q&A section of this episode. So the first question I wanted to answer was one that's kind of like a meta question about the podcast itself that was kind of funny and that I liked. And it's from a listener who just wants to be identified by her first name, Marlene. And this is a pretty easy one. She says, I really like the podcast theme song. What is it? So the podcast theme song, it's really funny because I hadn't actually thought about that in a few years because figured out the theme song back in 2012 when I first set up the podcast and haven't really thought about it that much since, except for that it's kind of become like the iconic intro and outro. And if Nick Dagan Best was here, he was supposed to be, but I think we lost track of him or he got caught up in something before he could join us. He likes to, of course, hum the theme song at the end when we're doing the outro at the end of episodes. So the answer to that question is that I actually bought the music. It's like the full clip is actually like 2 or 3 minutes. And I bought it from a website called jewelbeat.com. Since one of the guides to podcasting that I read back then said that you should just buy, that there's these websites that will sell, music where you can pay like $5 or $10 or something to buy a clip. And then you can use that clip in whatever, you know, whether it's a YouTube video or a podcast or something like that. It's a little trick that some podcasters use in order to have licensed music for things like that. So the title of the track is, it's kind of a generic sort of thing. I have no idea who composed it, but on their website, the title is Urban Cafe from the album Groove Cafe. The description says slow, cool, urban groove with strings and piano. And then Patrick, you might have more insight into this, what this means than I do. It has 90 beats per minute, and the key signature is E minor. Is that a good key?
Well, yes. It's easy to play in most instruments. E minor is any minor key is a more moody. Some people even say kind of sad sound, but it can also be used in a sort of cool way. So yeah, it is an E minor. That's about all I have to say about that.
Okay, I will take that cool and easy listening as well as moody and sad. So I'll actually play. What's funny is I hadn't listened to it, but I actually have the full. It's a full song of which I only play like 10 or 15 seconds of because I cut it down. But I'll, at the end of this episode, play the full song because I hadn't actually listened to it since I started the show. You know, what is it, 4 or 5 years ago now in 2012. So I'll actually play it at the end of this show and you'll actually hear the full thing, so that it's kind of funny when you listen to the full clip. All right, so that I think that's the only like meta question about the podcast itself, but I thought that was nice that was actually a really appropriate question for our 100th episode.
Woo!
So, yeah, right. Woo.
I mean, so that's Patrick, really awesome. That's some awesome, you know, this is something to celebrate. This is such a great thing for the astrological community. I think people are really happy that, you know, this is chugging along as well as it has, and people want it to continue. So I think this is a great time to celebrate the great podcast that this is.
Yeah, and it's really been wild because I initially inherited Traditional Astrology Radio, which was my prior podcast, from Jackie Minkus in like 2009 or 2010 on my birthday, actually, which at the time I thought was kind of interesting and significant, but I didn't realize to what extent, because it wasn't like a huge deal, because that wasn't a huge podcast at the time, but it was something that somebody else started and she handed it over to me when she got seriously into some, I think she was working on like a master's degree or something and couldn't do it anymore. So I took over that show and did it for a few years through Blog Talk Radio. And then in 2012, in like May or June, the domain theastrologypodcast.com was dropped, where you have to, every year you have to renew a domain. And if you don't pay the money to renew it, then after like a month or so of not paying the bill, eventually it just gets released back into the market. And then somebody could buy it if they notice that it's been dropped. So for whatever reason, I don't know how I noticed, but I noticed that it was available. And so I bought it immediately because having a domain like that, the astrology podcast, is just good for search engines. And so I actually looked and saw who the previous owner was, and it was astrologer Jeffrey Kirshner. Do you guys know who that is?
Yeah.
He does Sastrology. Yeah. So he does right. He runs the popular astrology website, sastrology.com. So I actually asked his permission and checked with him to make sure that that was cool and that he didn't drop it accidentally. And he said, no, that's fine. I had, you know, wanted to do something with it originally when I got it, but then don't really want to anymore. And I'll probably never get around to it. So go nuts. So he gave me his blessings. So I immediately sort of dropped the old podcast, Traditional Astrology Radio, and decided to set up the astrology podcast so that I could speak to a broader audience, both because I thought, you know, branding it as the astrology podcast would be better in terms of people finding it. Cause I figured like that's the search term that people probably look for, is they probably go to Google and type in astrology podcast and then click on whatever the first link is that comes up. So it would be easier to, you know, have people find it that way, but also that I wanted to do something more general, since even though I specialize in ancient astrology, you know, I also have broader interests, and my real focus is talking and studying many different traditions of astrology and integrating them together. So I think I said that all on the first podcast, but it's been amazing in retrospect how much we've been able to cover over the past 100 episodes. And Patrick, I believe you joined me for the fourth episode of the show, where we actually talked ironically about the astrology of the 2012 presidential election, right?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, you know, I was starting this podcast in May and June during the craziness of that whole election in 2012 and our extensive coverage of it. And that was sort of, it was just sort of a side thing that I started, and I tried to research it enough to do it the best possible way I could. And that's generally part of my like whole operating procedure when it comes to astrology in general over the past decade, has just been, if I get into something new, like find some guides and figure out what the best way is to do it right from the start, rather than just kind of learning and making mistakes as I go. But if I could figure out what the mistakes are to avoid right from the start, or what's the best way I could do it, then just do that right from the start by getting some advice from somewhere rather than by trial and error or what have you. So that's what I did at the start, and we're 100 episodes in. Are there any other, I don't know, things we should mention about that before launching into the rest of the questions?
No, I think that's it. I mean, you've covered just a really interesting breadth of topics and different styles of astrology and speakers and things. So I think it's really great that it's taken off the way that it has. And yeah, so it's a really good learning tool for free for the community.
It's an award-winning podcast.
Right. Literally an award-winning podcast. No longer just, up until last fall, it was figuratively, or at least in my mind, an award-winning, or should have been an award-winning podcast, but now it's literally an award-winning podcast. So, and one other thing, actually, because there's some things for the future, but Kelly, I was talking to Kelly recently, and Kelly suggested we do some sort of like party or get together with listeners at the United Astrology Conference next year, which is going to be the huge mega conference that's taking place in Chicago in May of 2018. And I think that's actually a great idea. So we're probably going to work on setting something like that up. I'd like to actually, though, maybe even do a test run at NORWAC this year. So at the Northwest Astrological Conference, which is taking place in Seattle at the end of May. I already promoted it on the last few episodes, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot of listeners already planning on attending. But I'd like to organize, if possible, some kind of get-together or some kind of meet-and-greet. And if we can pull it off, even maybe some kind of live episode, either just a recording of the audio podcast, or I was talking to Nicholas Polymenakis earlier today about possibly streaming a live episode on YouTube, since one of the things I want to get back to this year is branching out a little bit more into doing some stuff with video. So, you know, if anybody wants to meet up at this conference that's coming up in May, then that would be great. I know I met a bunch of people at the NCJR conference last month, and that was great. And I really appreciate everybody who came up and said hi. And also at the ESAR conference last fall. It's kind of hard, though, because you pass people in the hallway and you don't always get a lot of time to talk and stuff. So we're hoping to set up something more deliberate at NORWAC and then possibly at UAC next year as well. All right. And actually, before we move on, Patrick, you actually, speaking of moving into video, so you've started a new video series, right?
Yeah. I've been sort of rebranding my site, and my articles are now under the umbrella of my blog called Big Fat Astro Blog. And my video series is called Big Fat Astro Vlog. And I'm releasing videos every other every other Friday. And so I'm dropping my second episode on Friday. And you should check it out. It's on my Facebook page. And if you type in Big Fat Astro, you know, there's nothing else called Big Fat Astro out there. So it's good for search engines. taking a tip from Chris. Search Big Fat Astro. You'll find it. It's out there.
Brilliant. So your website redirects there. So this is your new project. And it's great. I love the first episode that you did, and I think it has a lot of potential. So I'm excited because and one of the next episodes I want to do is on sort of the phenomena of astrologers building large YouTube channels. And so there's some astrologers that are starting to get large followings there, which I'm very interested in and want to do some coverage of. But it's still kind of an area sort of like podcasting where there's not as many astrologers doing it yet as you think, and there's still a lot of room for growth. So I'm excited to see a new show like yours, and I think it's going to take off.
Well, hopefully we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. So let's jump into some questions here and get this Q&A rolling. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions that stood out or jumped out to you guys? There's a ton of good questions, and I have a very long list here where I've highlighted some of them. I don't know if there's any ones that stood out in particular to you guys or that you felt like you had a good answer for right off the top of your head.
I figured we maybe just go down the list. I didn't really have one that like spoke to me necessarily. There's definitely some things I have to say for some of them.
But okay. Let's just go from the top of the list then. So Nikki Allison writes in and she says, you once commented, I think it was you anyways, that electional charts are like the reverse or mirror image of a horary chart. Maybe you could discuss that in further detail. I'm particularly interested in whether horary rules apply for electional charts. I did mention that recently. I think I mentioned it in the forecast or in the electional episode that Lisa and I just did last month as well. So part of that, I mean, some of the history or the background surrounding that is about, more than a decade ago, probably like circa 2004, I had something that I was trying to start, and I realized that I needed to learn electional astrology in order to pick an auspicious chart for starting whatever that venture is that I was about to begin at that time. I think it was like signing a lease on an apartment or something like that, where I was signing it with like a roommate, and I was a little nervous about whether this was a good idea. So I at least wanted to have a good chart for doing that to sort of make it better than it might be otherwise. And I started looking for books on electional astrology, but unfortunately at the time I was surprised to find there was almost no books on electional astrology at that point. The only thing I could find was that there were like a couple of books on horary astrology, and sometimes the books on horary astrology would have like a little section on elections. And oftentimes it was because there seemed to be, or at least they were treating it as if there was quite a bit of interchange between the rules of electional and horary. And because horary at that point, especially in the late 20th century, was viewed as the more predictive form of astrology, and similarly, electional astrology had this almost more predictive quality that not a lot of like modern psychological astrologers necessarily had a lot of focus on or interest in. So they're kind of grouped together in that way. But the answer to that question, I think, is that to some extent, I think it is true that to some extent, there's a lot of interchangeability between electional charts and horary charts, or at least that you can treat them with the same rules. And to some extent, that's also true with natal astrology, where if you go, you know, a little bit back in, even though in modern times, we sort of treat these different branches as very separate, I think if you go back a little bit ways into the tradition, you start seeing a lot more crossover between the rules that are applied in electional and horary and natal charts than you do in modern times. And to that extent, I think there's a lot of similarities. I mean, what do you guys think? Is that, do you think horary rules apply to electional charts, or in what ways are they similar, or in what ways are they different?
So I don't usually practice horary, but I know the basics. And I mean, I think the basic gist about how they are similar is that in horary, you're interpreting what is likely to happen in the near future and what just happened in the near past. And when you're doing an electional chart, you're just simply trying to do that more proactively to plan what is about to happen in the near future and to select that. So I think that's the way in which they're similar, is that they show sort of events or qualities happening in time, but they are, but you're just deliberately choosing it for the election. That's all.
Yeah, I think they really are kind of a, it's more like a reverse, because I mean, basically in horary, you're asking about something in which the outcome is uncertain, whereas in electional, you are planning for something so that it is certain. So one is absolutely planned. One is and wants to achieve a desired outcome. The other is, you know, taking whatever comes, you know, whatever time you ask the question is the time that, or rather the time the question is understood is the chart, and you're not necessarily in control of that. Whereas electional absolutely is about having control. I think the general techniques that you can apply to a natal chart, or at least relating to aspects and house rulers, you know, are generally applicable, I think, across horary and electional.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, because there's, and it's like, you could argue this either way. And one of the things I'm sort of aware of in attempting to answer this is that whatever answer I give, I can think of some horary astrologers or some electional astrologers sort of having counter arguments or criticizing that if their approach or the things that they emphasize is different. But, you know, there are crossovers in the sense that, for example, in traditional electional and traditional horary, there's a lot of emphasis on the ruler of the ascendant as the most important planet, or one of the most important planets in terms of characterizing that chart and its focus. So that in an electional chart, you're trying to make sure that the ruler of the ascendant is well placed, because the first house and the planets associated with the first house, such as the ruler of the ascendant, are the ones most closely associated with whatever you're initiating or whatever is being born at that time. Whereas in a horary chart, the ruler of the ascendant is the one that is the planet that represents or most closely represents the person asking the question, but also by extension, therefore, to some extent, not just the person asking the question, but in some instances, sort of, it can also represent what they're focused on in the chart as well. So there are crossovers there. One of the differences, though, is like scope, since a horary question usually is typically limited to the specific question that was asked about. And sometimes with horary, you really have to narrow down the chart and focus on the specific significators that are relevant to the question. If the question was about like a relationship, then you focus on the ruler of the ascendant and the ruler of the seventh. Or if it was about, you know, the person's career, you focus on the ruler of the ascendant and the ruler of the 10th, or what have you. And in that way, horary can sometimes be much more focused on like dynamic considerations about aspects between those rulers, like whether they're applying to an exact aspect or whether they're separating. And whereas in electional astrology, while that's one of the things you can focus on, there's a lot of other things besides that, because the scope is much, much broader, where you're not trying to answer a specific question so much as you're trying to just create a chart that's generally supportive in a number of, in a wide variety of different ways for whatever that topic is that you're trying to promote or initiate.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So does that, you think that answers the question more or less? It's complicated because on they're very similar. There's similarities. There's definite similarities, and there's definite ways where if you learn the rules of one, you can apply some of those rules to the other very easily. But then sometimes due to the scope, there's some definite differences as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good answer.
All right. Cool. And let's see. Okay. So let's move on. Let's, you know, go through some questions relatively quickly here. Let's see. Robin Dorrell, who is a big fan of the show, asked a question where she says, I've been putting together a notebook of forecasting / predictive techniques I've been learning and thinking about their order of effectiveness, which ones to focus on first. It's helpful to keep the toolbox light and yet deep and intriguing. What techniques do you and your peers favor? So she says, she then gives a list of different predictive techniques, and she says, what order would you put these in? So she says, and I haven't ordered them, but she says, circumambulations through the bounds, which is another sort of phrase for describing primary directions, zodiac releasing, primary directions, which is actually the same as zodiac releasing, perfections, solar returns, secondary progressions, solar arc directions, antitia and contra-antitia, many other techniques I haven't explored, decennials, quarters of the moon, and the 129-year system. So many of these, actually, she's reading from Delphic Oracle, since many of these are Hellenistic Time Lord techniques, but some of them are also modern timing techniques as well. And I think this is a tricky question to ask, because every astrologer or different schools of astrology are going to have different techniques that they emphasize just based on their own personal preferences and their personal approach, either in terms of the school of astrology that they come from or in terms of just what's worked out better or been more effective for them individually. I think that's a pretty safe statement to make, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's a little tricky too with the three of us on this show, because I think there's quite a lot of overlap between how we approach charts.
Yeah, it's like we've all been doing astrology together for like a decade now, so we all have very similar approaches, I think, at this point, more or less, right?
Well, yeah, I guess what I would say is that, I mean, she asked, what techniques do you and your peers favor? I probably favor using annual perfections, and I get a lot out of zodiacal releasing, at least in charts that support it. I do keep an eye on antitia and contra-antitia relationships between planets. The ones that I don't tend to look at too much, and ones that I haven't even really explored yet, are decennials, quarters of the moon, the 129-year system. Those are still really fruitful areas for research. There's a lot of ways in which some of the Time Lord systems bear relationships to the others, especially with quarters of the moon. There are some analogs, I think, between some of the things in zodiacal releasing. For example, there's kind of an analog to the loosing of the bond in quarters of the moon that I wonder if it is similar in some way to zodiacal releasing. But circumambulations through the bounds, I think, is often recommended as like the first thing you're supposed to look at a chart if you're going to be ultra strict about it, because before you make any prognostication about a chart, you should check and see if they're even going to live to see it.
Right. That's a statement but I tend Ptolemy makes that he quotes Pedicerus for.
Yeah. So I tend to be a little more optimistic when I meet with someone. You know, when I talk with someone, I tend to presume that they're going to live, you know, some normal time span. So I'm a little more trusting. So I don't really use circumambulations to the bounds or primary directions. I do examine stellar returns occasionally, and I kind of keep my eye on secondary progressions. But yeah, the ones that I kind of keep coming back to are annual perfections and, when applicable, Sadaka releasing for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the same for me. I mean, yeah, circumambulations or primary directions was originally tied in with the length of life treatment, as you're saying, in traditional astrology. And I know there's actually some amazing work that's been done on that by astrologers like Martin Ganston, who I'd like to interview at some point, who wrote this amazing book on primary directions. And I know other astrologers like Ben Dykes have used primary directions both generally as well as in other applications, like in the solar return chart, for in very interesting ways. So I know there's some astrologers doing interesting things like that. I know Nick Dagan-Best and I tried to research it with the length of life technique like 10 years ago, but we could only get it to work like maybe 30 or 40% of the time. And when it was working, it was dead on, but when it was off, it was just way off. And so that was one of the early researches I had into primary directions. And in all reality, I probably just wasn't applying it as strenuously as somebody like Ben Dykes or Martin Ganston did, and therefore wasn't as impressed with it at the time. And that's what led me to using things like zodiac releasing and annual perfections more, because they were really quickly just out of the box delivering pretty impressive results. So prior to that, as a modern astrologer, I think, you know, it's divided into different schools. Like, if you're a modern astrologer, then the three main techniques or timing techniques that most modern astrologers use are like transits primarily, secondary progressions as the secondary thing, and then solar arcs is pretty popular with some schools, like the cosmobiologists or the Uranian astrologers, but also with some of the modern schools like Noel Till and some of his students and people. And that's one of the other major timing techniques. The other one is solar returns, which is used to some extent in modern astrology. And that's also very prominent in medieval astrology to some extent as well. In other traditions like Indian astrology, it's like there's this one timing technique called the Vimshodari Dasha system that everybody uses. And then there's some other sort of other techniques like transits or other dasha systems as well that are used. But it's a little bit more uniform in terms of everybody at least using that one technique as a starter because it's so effective. And I think we're starting to come to something like that to some extent in the Hellenistic tradition. I don't know if that's an overstatement on my part, but I feel like zodiac releasing and perfections are kind of almost on that level with the level of acceptance that they have amongst some practitioners of Hellenistic astrology over the past 10 years, where we might see that becoming like a mainstream thing, like the Vimshodari Dasha system is for most Vedic astrologers. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's getting there for sure. And I mean, what I end up looking at first is zodiacal releasing, just because it is like the dasha system, you know, like divides up long periods of time. So it gives you kind of like the big picture context of what's going on in someone's life. And then annual perfections kind of right underneath that in terms of what order, you know, I would put it in for looking at that year and what, you know, kind of themes are going to be most important for that year, what kind of quality. And then underneath that, I would say I would glance at the secondary progressions, but usually that's quite quick because there's not something going on most of the time that's really exact in progressions because things move slowly. And then underneath that, I would say eclipses and transits.
I'd also like to say that perfections and solar returns are actually, they work in tandem oftentimes. Right. I mean, because you're looking at, for example, planets in the sign of the annual perfection at the time of the solar return can also be perfected planets. Even if you don't have planets natally in a given sign, if there are planets in that sign at the time of the solar return, then those planets end up being perfected for the year. So the perfections and solar returns are kind of, or rather should be considered together. That's if you want to kind of really get into it. You can still get a lot of really good results from annual perfections, just, you know, use within the context of the natal chart, without having to invoke the solar return necessarily. One thing, I don't know if you guys have an opinion on this, but you know, there are statements which Valens makes about how not necessarily all charts are as telling as another. For example, if the ruler of the Lot of Fortune falls amiss, you know, if it's in a bad place, that the lots don't always reveal as much as they could if, for example, the ruler of the Lot of Fortune fell in a good sign or in a good house. I don't know if you've seen this, but I've kind of come into this issue sometimes where I'm not entirely sure. Like in some charts, it's like so clear, it's so blindingly obvious, you know, how the Zodiac releasing periods match up with someone's life that, you know, it's just self-evident. Like it's so clear. But in other charts where it's less obvious, I kind of wonder if we should consider that maybe not all charts respond, or rather there might be some Time Lord methods which certain charts respond to better than others, given whatever layout of the chart that they have.
That's an interesting... I was going to say that's an interesting question. Have you noticed in those charts where it doesn't seem to be working as well for you that they do have one of those conditions in the natal chart?
Well, for example, and this is goes to one of the other questions that we have to address, but for example, in the chart of Trump, you know, he has this Lot of Fortune in Aquarius and his Saturn is in Cancer, which if he's Leo rising, then Saturn falls amiss. But if he's Virgo rising, then it would be, you know, in the 11th. And it's just been difficult with his Zodiac releasing because while there do seem to be some general things that match up, you know, part of the basis of my failed 2016 prediction for him was the fact that he was in a cadent period. And that wouldn't be what I would expect for someone who was going to be reaching, you know, a very, very high rank. And there might be other reasons that can account for that. And it's a very, you know, obviously this topic goes down a rabbit hole that I didn't have to get into just this moment. But that whole issue with this chart and his Zodiac releasing from spirit kind of makes me wonder if maybe Zodiac releasing from spirit may not be the best technique to apply to his chart. You know, if the ruler of his Lot of Fortune falls amiss, as Valens suggests, certain charts may be less telling than others.
Yeah, and there's a whole sort of thing about that, just because there's ways that Valens uses the technique and outlines it that, you know, we've either not followed, or there's different applications where when you're reviving a technique, there's still things that we're learning about it. You know, that's one of the things that's interesting about something like secondary progressions is like it's been in use in the astrological tradition for 300 or 400 or 500 years at least, and in common use in the astrological tradition. Whereas with Zodiac releasing, it's literally no one has been using it for over 1,000 years now. And then suddenly in the past 10 years, it's like, you know, us, and we're like in our teens and 20s, like start using this second century technique again and applying it to charts, or applying it to our love life, or applying it to whatever and trying to see what it can do. And yeah, there's a lot of things like that we're still learning. But I want to wrap this up so we can move on. I mean, my heart hierarchy at this point is like Zodiac releasing, perfections, transits, and that in and of itself is enough and more that you can do in most charts, to the extent that I've neglected secondary progressions and solar arcs and things like that. Even though I know they work, I don't discount them or know their effectiveness, but there's only so many things you can do. And I think that's what all astrologers run into, is at some point you've got to draw a line between which techniques are most important and most effective for you to use versus which ones aren't going to give you as much information or won't give you the type of information that you want in the way that you want it. But everybody sort of draws that line at a different place. And I know, you know, I know Benjamin Dykes does. I know Dimitri George does, because Dimitri uses, as I said, solar returns and perfections together. Ben uses primary directions and solar returns and other things like that. So everybody draws that line differently, but that's sort of my hierarchy. Although I will say that, as I said in the past few episodes, some of the things that happened with secondary progressions in the recent presidential election reignited my interest in secondary progressions and in their importance. So I will say that much. I mean, you guys noticed some of those things as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How Trump's progressions became Bill Clinton's chop.
Mm.
Right. Or like, I think it was like Trump's, was it his son,
Progress son conjunct the ascendant when he became very, very prominent right. in the run-up.
More so yes. than he had been in his life prior to.
Right. So there's some stuff like that that's impressive and just reminded me of how useful some of those techniques, you know, could be, and that it was just something I wasn't paying attention to because I was so focused on these other ones. So on the one hand, you want to be able to pay attention to a lot of different techniques. On the other hand, there's only so many you can do. And there's also a drawback if you're trying to do everything. And I've seen some astrologers, there's a certain end of that spectrum where there's a, like a type of astrologer that attempts to do everything. And sometimes I feel like that really comes out as like a hodgepodge that isn't as effective as you would think it is. Sometimes just like a multiplicity of using every technique is less effective than using one or two techniques really well. So that's what I'll say about that. And we can move on. There's a string of questions, several questions from a listener named Christopher DiCarlo that were all like really good. And I wanted to address a few of them. One of his first ones was, do you use declination in your practice? And if so, how? Do either of you use declinations or out of bounds or contra parallels or any of that stuff?
I don't regularly. I mean, I do think there's validity to the out of bounds planets, and it's kind of interesting to see sometimes in people's natal charts, but I don't routinely use them.
Yeah, not routinely. I do sometimes take notice of out of bounds declinations just because sometimes I had a really good example of one a couple of years ago, I think. Usain Bolt, the fastest man alive, has Mars severely out of bounds. You know, so he has this like, you know, cool. really kind of wild Mars, you know, really out of bounds. And he is the, you know, fastest man alive. So I thought that was kind of a cool example of out of bounds declination. And parallels, contra parallels, I may be making a mistake here. Is that the same thing as Antitia, contra Antitia?
Well,
I've heard those terms used interchangeably, but maybe I just confused them. But yeah, I don't really pay too much attention to declination, but I do sometimes take notice of out of bounds planets.
Sure. Yeah, and it's not something I pay much attention to at all. But I did at a lecture, I'm like periodically reminded that I should be. It's one of those things that in sort of standard Western astrology, you don't often, but there's like some astrologers that really specialize in that or really focus on that. But for some reason, it has never caught on as much as it sort of should. And I was reminded of that at the recent NCGR conference where I sat in on a great lecture by an astrologer named Adam Gainsburg, who gave a talk on, it was sort of broadly on like visual or observational astrology, where you're paying more attention to not just like the ephemeris or looking at the computer screen, but actually looking up into the sky at what different planetary alignments look like visually. And when you do that, you actually become much more aware of things like declination, where one of his points, for example, is that like a conjunction between two planets isn't necessarily a full conjunction in the way that we think about it.
It's not an occultation, right? It's by latitude.
Right. So like an occultation would be when visually like the body of one planet or one celestial object literally passes over and covers up the body of another planet. So like we think of like a classic exact solar eclipse, for example, is when the moon like completely covers the sun. And that would be when they're both at the same degree of longitude, which is the degrees of the zodiac, essentially. That's what the zodiac represents, is degrees of longitude, but also degrees of latitude. So you can kind of think of it like longitude is sort of like being on the same plane horizontally in some abstract sense, whereas declination is like the same latitude. So sort of like being on the same plane vertically. And you have to have both of those frames of references align perfectly in order for a complete sort of like true ideal conjunction to take place. But in reality, most of the time, most conjunctions that astrologers are looking at, they're just lining up on the ecliptic, so occupying the same degree of longitude, but they may be very sort of far north or south of each other, so that it's actually not a true occultation, like Patrick was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, so I don't pay attention to that as much as I should, but periodically I am reminded by people like Adam Gainsburg that I should be, and I'm interested in looking into that more in the future. So he's doing some really interesting stuff with visual astrology like that, that are taking components like that into account. I know his two co-workers or partners in their astrological studies are doing similar things with visual astrology, and they're actually doing a conference next year, I think called the Sky Astrology Conference, I want to say. Is that right, Lisa?
I think so.
Okay, so Gary Caton and so it's Adam Gainsburg, Gary Caton, and why am I blanking out on her name
Julian.
Right now? And Julian Packer Lewis, who works at the School of Astrology, the International Academy of Astrology, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're very much focused, from what I can tell, on that more visual component of astrology. And so they're doing some interesting work in that area. So I'd recommend checking out their work, especially Adam Gainsburg's work, for more information about that.
I would second that recommendation. And also for anyone who is interested in the piece about out of bounds planets, Tony Howard has a very good lecture that I heard at the ESAR conference last October about out of bounds planets and like each individual planet and what it showed in kind of famous people's charts historically and how it did or did not reinforce what you would expect from that particular planet, like say a Mercury out of bounds versus a Venus out of bounds.
Sure. All right, so let's jump back into the questions here. So we've gone through a few already. We actually didn't get very far, so we're going to speed up a little bit so we can get through some more in a reasonable time span. Christopher DiCarlo, we were answering some of his questions. He had a lot of good ones. I don't know if we can do all of them. Did any of these stand out to you guys as ones that you want to jump on?
I mean, I think a really interesting one for all of us is how is practicing astrology influenced who you are as a person and your worldview? Because I think it does really interesting things to your mind and your sense of time and things like that when you've been doing astrology for a while. And I think especially when you learn new techniques and what the ramifications of those are. So, I mean, I know Chris and I have both had interesting experiences around learning zodiacal releasing and how that influenced our view of, you know, fate and free will and things like that. And I think for me, it's just, I think the overall gist is just that the universe is very weird. And I think I went from thinking, being kind of agnostic about life and not sure if there was like a greater organization or meaning, to seeing that there were these really weird structures underlying time.
Right. But that's actually one of the points we've debated, you and I, right? Because one of that's always like a hard conclusion that I've drawn from astrology, which is that to the extent that astrology works, it seems to imply that the universe and especially individual lives are more purposeful and have more sort of meaning built into them than we might expect. And then compared to many mainstream contemporary philosophers, or at least in terms of the sort of like atheistic scientific worldview, where there's almost this feeling of almost being exalted by the lack of meaning in the universe and in the complete, you know, our isolation on a small, it's often described as like we're like a speck of a germ that's like on a small rock that's floating in like an infinite universe. And our lives in that context don't have any greater meaning or purpose. And one of the conclusions I often would draw from astrology is it seems to almost contradict that in some sense. But that's a point where I, at least a few years ago, I remember you being more reluctant to jump all the way to that conclusion or something. Do you feel like you're still at that place, Lisa, or where do you come down on that now?
I think where I come down on that is that I see the structures, and so I see that there's some organization to things. And I think that you can infer meaning from watching astrology work, but it still doesn't necessarily give you what the meaning is. So I think that's where I am as far as how practicing astrology over time has influenced my view of some of these things.
Yeah, for me, I've kind of gone through a lot of the same thoughts that you guys have had. I think I end up falling out a little closer to Chris, where I think that to design, it doesn't have to, but it doesn't necessarily have to, but to me, it implies purpose. And I think it definitely is hard to, it's hard to think that the world is just meaningless and that it's just a, you know, materialist kind of scenario that we're in. The world is super weird. There's something very, very strange going on here, and that things are kind of ordered, and that does appear to be some kind of thing that does care about what happens down here. So, yeah, from that point of view, I think in some ways it's made me kind of more confidently a theist, because it's something I don't really talk about too much. I don't really talk about like the spiritual implications of astrology, but they are kind of huge. And it's a bit mind blowing to really kind of take it seriously. I definitely think that astrology has more or less, for me, it sort of confirms that, you know, there is kind of a thing or some sort of consciousness or what have you that is conscious of us as we are conscious of it.
Sure. And that's a really interesting topic that actually we could do an entire episode on, and I'd almost like to, but I'd like to keep going on it, but I'd actually hesitate to, because I know how easy it would be for us to talk about that for like the next 45 minutes. He had a few other really good questions though. He had one, which was, what is something about your natal chart that resonates with you personally? In other words, what characteristics about your chart do you feel are the most valid in describing a part of who you are? Does any of you have one of those that really stands out right now or seems really pertinent at the moment?
Well, when I look at my own chart and I try to forget that I've looked at it millions of times, I just try to look at the ruler of the first, the ruler of the ascendant. So for me, I was born with Leo rising, which makes the sun the lord of the first. And I have the lord of the first opposite Jupiter. And so the thing that people always kind of tell me about myself is that I tend to make promises that I can't keep. I have problems with, indulgence, and tend to be lazy. I tend to procrastinate, tend to put things off. I tend to be very optimistic. I tend to, have a big heart, but sometimes it comes at the expense of, my health and my, general, luck in the world. So I can appreciate in my own chart how having this sort of stressful opposition from Jupiter to my ruler of the first, reflects in these kinds of issues I have with excess and indulgence and being overly generous in some sense.
Sure. That's a good one.
Sure. Since Chris already revealed in his acknowledgments in his book that I have a moon in Virgo, I'll talk about that placement. I think all of the chart placements are completely valid in describing who I am, but the moon in Virgo, I think it's kind of funny that I was proofreading the book, and that's what he was referring to in the acknowledgments. And actually, as far back as I can remember, the moon is often referred to as something that is a very instinctual part of you. That's how you react very easily to things. And from when I was in elementary school, even, I was proofreading and editing my parents' business communications and documents. So in terms of attention to detail, that's always been something that has just been very natural for me. So I guess that's a piece I would talk about.
Totally. And I just got a message from Nick. Nick Diggenbest is available and wants to join us. Should we patch him in?
Sure.
Patch him in.
Okay, I'm here. I am back.
You're back. All right, nice. All right, and very quickly, I mean, my placements, one of the ones I would highlight is my Mercury-Saturn conjunction, because this is actually a good example of a positive thing you can probably take from astrology, which is that when I got into astrology when I was like 15 or 14 or something, I definitely, a lot of the interpretations I resonated with, one that stood out was just their general delineations of a Mercury-Saturn conjunction as somebody that has a difficult time communicating. And I think that's really ironic now, but it's sort of an inspiring and useful example, because I had a lot of difficulties communicating and was really timid about talking, especially in groups growing up, ironically. So that was a process that changed, and I got better at, and I still have some challenges with, like, Lisa and I always joke about how I'm constantly mispronouncing things. And if somebody's followed this podcast for long enough, you've actually probably caught it quite frequently, I think. Right, Lisa?
Yeah. I mean, from time to time.
From time to time.
I'm being polite.
So that's actually something really funny. And even Nick, you know, when I met you, Nick, that was still, the idea of me giving a talk or something was very wild, and yeah. I just started lecturing. You saw some of my first lectures.
Can I tell the funny story about right, like, the second time I met you? We first met in Seattle in person. We had already known each other online, and then we met up again in Chicago at the ESTAR conference. This is late August 2005, and I was already booked to speak on a panel at the conference. There were a few of us there. I remember Mark Kunzel was there. And all the different speakers had to pass around this one microphone that we spoke into with our voices booming out of the PA system. And as I recall, you were added to the panel sort of at the last minute. You were totally unknown at the time. You weren't even 21 yet. So you're a young 20-year-old guy. And I'm pretty sure you had never heard your voice through a PA system before. I used to play in bands, so I was kind of used to it. But I just remember how timid you were speaking into this microphone, and how there was a visible look of fear or shock on your face when you heard your voice coming out of the PA system. Obviously, you've come a long way since then, but just thinking of, you know, who you were when I met you, I can definitely see that conjunction coming out there.
Yeah, it was definitely much more prominent early in my life, and then in each sort of successive, especially the hard aspects of Saturn to that, I seem to have gone through different stages of breaking through that, and then it becoming more constructive, where originally something that was like a weakness or a shortcoming became more of a strength. And so that's one of the things that's really ironic now. If, you know, anybody who knew me 10 or 20 years ago, you know, if you told them that I was, you know, I did a regular podcast that lots of people listened to, or that I traveled around the world giving lectures, or like wrote a book or something, they would think you're crazy. So I use that only because I think it's a really good and maybe useful example for some people, that sometimes there can be placements in your chart that are difficulties that sometimes can morph or change over the course of a person's life and become strengths, or sometimes become reversed in some ways, even if they always still have some lingering, you know, meaning that is tied into that.
Yeah, especially Saturn aspects, because the whole thing about your Saturn-Mercury journey has been to work on this problem, not merely to sort of accept it as a fait accompli in your personality, but to overcome it, to put the work in and get yourself from point A to point B.
Right, yeah, definitely. Sure. And I know that's not necessarily going to be that way for everybody. And there's different types of placements that sometimes can be more, you know, challenging or more overwhelming of issues. There's a whole spectrum there. But, you know, sometimes that's a good lesson, or good astrology lesson to keep in mind. So Christopher DiCarlo had a bunch of other good questions. I want to jump around and maybe come back later to some of his, just so we can get to some other people. And then we'll see if we can circle around later. So let's see. One of the next questions was, how would you interpret or reconcile those cases where the degree of the MC or the meridian is in a different sign than the 10th whole sign house. And this is from Arina Matchkaboji, whose name I'm definitely mispronouncing. I apologize ahead of time. Any of you guys want to take this?
For me, I would just, I pay more attention to the sign ruler of the whole sign 10th house, and then the house where the midheaven degree is placed, but not necessarily quite as much the sign. That's how I go.
Well, I think what Valen says is that the sign that the MC falls in takes on the significations of the 10th. So that doesn't mean you have two, I guess it means you have like one proper 10th and then one incidental 10th. I mean, people are able to wrap their heads around intercepted houses. So, I mean, it's not that much of a leap to have, you know, two houses which can, or two rather two signs which can have a similar signification. I have seen a few examples where when the MC is in a different sign than the 10th house that sometimes, for example, there's an example of the MC being in someone's 11th house and transits through the 10th house were like big in what they did. But when the transits moved to their 11th and hit the MC, that was kind of the final point of that was like the kind of the full stop of the action up until that point. So it was sort of a leading up to, you know, the event, the MC. I presume that in the 9th house, if the MC came before the 10th, that maybe you'd start off with a bang and then continue working on whatever it is you're doing as, you know, planets transit through your 10th.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say for my part, I already have a very fluid view of the houses. The succedent and cadent houses that flank the angular house already have a connection to that angular house in my mind. So I have to say, I haven't looked at a lot of charts with 12th house midheavens, you know, like people in Norway or whatever. But in terms of 11th or 9th house midheavens, I already, in terms of how I view the houses, there's already a sort of fluid relationship. And the 9th and 11th are already tied to the 10th as it is. And sort of like what Watson's saying, wherever the midheaven angle, the pivot falls, tends to be a sort of climax point in whatever story is unfolding over the course of a given transit. You know, they're already connected in my mind, and it's not too confounding. The pivot falls where it does, and that comes out in the way that, you know, the chart responds to transits or what have you.
Yeah, and I would just say that the degree of the midheaven or the meridian imports 10th house significations into whatever whole sign house it falls, and then there's just a doubling up. And that's true in both as a natal interpretation, where sometimes you can just take that straight and say, you know, if the midheaven falls in the 9th whole sign house, that sometimes 9th house topics and 10th house topics are going to get mixed. So a famous example of that, of course, is Robert Hand, who's like a famous astrologer in his career, is very much tied in with astrology, and that's how his MC in the 9th whole sign house manifests. Other people, sometimes like myself, for example, my MC falls in the 11th house, and sometimes groups or organizations or my friends, for example, become very much tied in with my career. So that's true both as an isolated natal interpretation you can make, but it also comes up very clearly in the timing techniques, or comes up the most clearly in timing techniques like transits, where if you see, you know, a planet or a major outer planet transit going over the MC in one of those other whole sign houses, you're going to see both the whole sign house significations and the MC significations coming up at the same time. There's more we could say about that. I talk a little bit about that in the book, and I think I give a few examples of that. So I'll leave that for there. Let's see. Another question that the same listener had was, do either of your guests have natal charts that look significantly different when using quadrant houses versus whole sign houses? If that's the case, how smoothly did your conceptual transition to whole sign houses go? Did you feel almost right away that it made much more sense, or did you initially resonate strongly with the quadrant house chart? She has a few other points, but go ahead.
Yeah, mine doesn't change too much. I think it moves my Venus, depending on, it's a difference between Placidus and Koch. Like one Venus is in the second house, the other Venus is in the first. But for the most part, there isn't much difference. It wasn't hard for me to make the transition. It was relatively early in my study. When I converted to whole sign houses, it was maybe 3 years into my study of astrology. I'd already done a lot of work with the other house systems. I went to Rob Hand's lecture in New York City, and he spoke about them. And I think the reason it resonated with me was I always discerned, I was right from the beginning of my study looking at transits, I always saw a planet's ingress into a new sign as being a new prospect, a new situation. And so doing the sort of sign as house thing made perfect sense, rather than trying to sort of split them in some kind of what I found to be a clumsy and ambiguous fashion. It consolidated what I was seeing and gave me a focus that I wouldn't otherwise have had. I found any other house system trying to use them was kind of baffling, and I couldn't really figure out the reason to do it.
So it was a pretty easy transition for you. What about you guys, Lisa?
Yeah, I always love to be a good example of complete resistance against whole sign houses, because it was not a smooth transition for me. And I think some of it was, you know, just investment. Like, I had invested time and attention, and what I had seen so far in charts, in my own chart and other people's charts, made sense in that way. And so I guess the resistance for me at first was that it was kind of saying that was invalid or like completely wrong. And I think that was a lot of the issue for me. And I know that at the time, it sort of took seeing how, after looking at it for a little bit, it took seeing how some of the same things could be explained from a different angle using a different house system. So it wasn't that it completely invalidated those interpretations. It was just that they came about technically in a different way. So say a planet wasn't in a particular house anymore, but then the ruler of the house explained it in whole sign houses. So that was definitely an issue for me. But now I predominantly use whole sign houses, and I think that it really explains concrete circumstances in different areas of life really well. And I think it doesn't invalidate like the Placidus chart observations, but sometimes I see that can be kind of a little bit of an overlay, and sometimes maybe explain the psychology of someone a little bit. Yeah, so that's kind of how it went for me. Not smooth.
For me, I was born right after a new moon in late Libra, so my moon is in Scorpio, even though my sun is at the very end of Libra, and my moon's at 2 Scorpio, and my IC is at 3 Scorpio. So when I first started astrology, I thought my moon was in my third house, even though it's very closely conjunct to the IC. And by whole sign houses, my moon is in my fourth. And so for me, I was learning about how whole sign houses was able to help me just figure out what was going on. Like, okay, so my sun is conjunct my IC, but it's really in my third. And moon is conjunct the IC, but it's really in my fourth. Maybe helped me kind of understand the difference between my sun in late Libra versus my moon in early Scorpio by understanding that they're actually in different houses as well as different signs. And I've always found the ingresses to be really impressive. So I kind of like Nick, the ingresses seem to kind of already kind of say what could be said by, you know, transiting a house cusp, as it were. So it was a fairly easy transition for me. It has not been for my mom, and I've tried to you know, tell her that her, you know, 30 degrees of Pisces intercepted in the first house, you know, isn't really what she thinks it is, but she's way too invested in everything I've thrown at her about her chart, like, and showing like how different things could be in her chart could be, you know, said to make more sense under house sign houses. I haven't been able to convince her. So she's just convinced. She's convinced that she has an intercepted first house because she is compassionate towards animals. That's her reasoning. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, it really does, you know, get into your conception of yourself and sort of being used to seeing that a certain way and how your chart interprets that a certain way. So it can be hard to kind of shift that.
Well, and she had a really hard time when I told her that Saturn was her ascendant ruler instead of Uranus, especially since Uranus is a lot cooler than Saturn. So, yeah, a little, yeah, it's a bit difficult.
And then, I mean, ties back into the previous question about, you know, how is astrology influenced who you are as a person in your worldview? And part of the broader answer to that is that all astrologers inevitably end up partially, you know, conceptualizing their life and perceiving part of who they are through their chart to some extent, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. And that's why sometimes some of these debates about things like house division or like sign rulership or whatever become really hot debates in the astrological community, or sometimes, you know, in instances in the past in this podcast become like arguments and like knockdown, you know, brawls or something. It's because astrologers, you know, oftentimes come to closely identify with their chart, and there becomes this perception of like, if this is true for me, that means, you know, these other approaches must be false or something like that. Or sometimes it can get framed in that way, or at least sometimes it can become so highly personal that astrologers do, can get kind of touchy about it.
Yeah. It's, the whole thing about being so personally identified with astrology, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, when I got into astrology, it helped me a great deal in terms of understanding myself and how I was growing or not growing in the world, or how I could accept certain aspects of my personality. But at the same time, I think very early on, I realized that I didn't want my investigation of astrology to be too closely tied to my own, to my inner world. I really wanted to be looking out because, you know, I was aware of just how subjective the whole thing was. I think also there was an underlying thing. When I was studying astrology, I was aware, I mean, this is the kind of thing I think a lot of people studying face, when you see something that looks grim on the horizon and it can sort of freak you out or make you paranoid about what's coming down the road. I really early in my study, I saw that over a decade away, I would have this progression with a solar eclipse conjunct Uranus, and it looked really gnarly. And the transits that would be happening when I had that progression involved Saturn, and it looked very scary. And I spent over a decade sort of trying to tune that out. And maybe that was the other reason that I decided to sort of not think about my own chart when studying astrology, but just sort of be looking at the world. And sure enough, when the time came, it was everything I could have been paranoid about and more so. It involved an illness and, you know, just sort of losing a lot of things that were important in my life. You know, in other words, the paranoia was in its own way justified, but there was nothing I could do about it. Hmm. So it's a weird thing. At the same time, I published something right at that same time, also during that progression, that to this day, astrologers still refer to. It was an article about Venus retrogrades. I wrote it over, it's now almost 10 years ago. And even just yesterday, I was listening to a lecture Gary Caton had given at the SOTA conference last year, and he referred to that article. And Sam Reynolds recently, in one of his articles about Venus retrograde, referred to that article. So it's almost like that, like, you know, if I hadn't survived what happened then, I had sort of made something of a legacy for myself. So it's a weird double-edged sword, and I don't know why I'm going off on this strand, but I think the question of astrologers really identifying so closely with their own charts in lieu of their broader investigation of astrology can just as easily be shooting yourself in the foot as it can be a means of growing as a person.
Yeah, and it really varies from astrologer to astrologer, and also astrologers go through different phases, I think, in their career and their studies of astrology and this like relationship with astrology, where sometimes people have like a more constructive or like healthy view of it or healthy approach to it, and other times in your life you might have like a less healthy sort of approach to it, and that sort of waxes and wanes depending on different circumstances. I know one thing that Lisa and I have been talking about a lot lately, or a little bit lately, and we coined in our last electional episode for patrons, was the what was the phrase again, Lisa?
The tyranny of the rising signs.
Right. That's what we're calling it these days, like this sort of like hyper awareness, because now, you know, with this modern software and stuff, it's like you can have solar fire running in the background so that you know what the chart is for your location at any time in the day. And, you know, doing electional astrology as much as we do, it sort of creates this like hyper awareness of that and what the different rising signs are and which ones are better or worse, or like which times during the day, if something major is initiated, when you're going to run into more problems or could run into setbacks or difficulties, you know, like if Saturn, for example, is rising over the ascendant, as it is lately, right now. So, but that hyper awareness, while sometimes it can be useful, and at least ideally in an ideal world with electional astrology, what you're trying to do is like maximize your effectiveness at different points. Sometimes it can also lead to this, you know, overly focusing on that. And sometimes almost this like paralysis, if like, you know, should I send this important email right now when Mars is like right on the ascendant, or should I seriously put off what I would otherwise do for like a few hours just in order to get a better chart? And sometimes when it gets to that, it starts getting a little questionable, and you start wondering, you know, is this something that's constructive, or is this something that's, you know, not healthy on some level?
Yeah, I'd rather have electional regret. I have a lot of electional regrets. That's where you do something and then you're like, oh, damn, was that even a good time to do that? And then you check the charts and of course it wasn't.
Right.
Yeah, I've sent many a poorly timed email, but I only knew after the fact. So I was like, fucking hell. I really said that with that shot. Like, and of course it like, you know, wouldn't go over well. My request would be denied or whatever it was. So,
right. Yeah.
Electional regrets.
Yeah. I tend to find, I mean, the electional is always a tricky thing because you don't always have that much choice to have a good electional. And then you can kind of presume, well, you know, some things just aren't meant to be. That tends to be, you know, I've become more and more philosophical on that end when it comes to choosing electionals. You simply can't control everything, can you?
Right. Well, one of the things, though, that's hard also is that sometimes you'll notice that, but even if you're aware sometimes that it's like a terrible chart, your impulse sometimes will still be, you know, I don't care. I'm still want to do it right now.
I that is so me all the time. Like, I will take you on, universe.
Right.
I will overcome you. I defy you. And then, of course, I get slapped down. Yeah.
I actually...
Yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
I really rarely do that these days, even when I want to, because I had such a striking bad experience with that early on when I was first learning about these things. And I had to... I was breaking my lease in Boulder when I was moving to Denver, and... It should have been a really easy room to rent out. It's really cheap, great location, etc. And I needed to place the room for rent on Craigslist and to find a replacement for myself. And, you know, I was talking to Chris at the time online, and he was like, well, you can't always, you know, choose the best moment. Sometimes practicality just wins out. And we didn't really talk further about that. So I just posted it on Craigslist. And I happened to realize later that I posted it when Saturn was, I don't know, either rising or on the ascendant. I don't know how exactly, but it was Saturn in a night chart in the first house. And it ended up being like months and months of it not being rented out and me paying for two apartments when like I couldn't, you know, I had very little money and I was working every single day of the week for months. And it was such a striking example that I was like, I am never doing that again. So
I was driving back from Texas to Arizona and I noticed that the moon was applying to a Mars retrograde in Libra in my third. And I was like, fuck this, you know, that's either like a crash or something. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be, you know, we have to get home quickly, but I'm going to, you know, just be careful. But I got stopped by a cop for speeding. Yeah, right. In fact, it was right as the moon was conjunct Mars, because I looked it up later because it took down the time, and I was like, "Fucking hell!" I really like I knew it was something. I thought it was gonna be a crash, but no, it was the cops and a $300 bill. The right. Only time I ever got stopped for speeding.
And it's like sometimes you can't avoid those things. Other times. And that's not just an electional astrology, but that's actually a broader issue that all astrologers, I think, eventually wrestle with, is that even in your natal chart, sometimes like your natal impulses to do certain things, or sometimes when you're experiencing a transit, one of the things that's the most difficult philosophically and practically as an astrologer is that sometimes your impulse is to do exactly that thing, which rationally, if you're looking at it from an objective astrological standpoint, you think, you know, certainly I shouldn't do that, or this is going to be a problematic outcome, or I can see how these energies are not going to manifest in a great way. But at the time, once you're in the midst of it, sometimes that's the exact thing that you want to do. And every impulse of your being is just sort of like drawing you towards doing or initiating that action at the time. And it takes a great deal of willpower or something to overcome that. Or in some instances, once you actually get in the midst of it, you realize, you know, no, this is something I've seen coming that looks bad for a long time, but then you actually get there and you realize that this is something I actually need to do and need to experience. And you sort of go through with it at the time, because it turns out that somehow in this weird, not twisted way, but this like ironic way, that that's the thing that you're supposed to do at that time in some broader sense.
Yeah.
Even if it's making a mistake or something.
Yeah, that's the anecdote I was sharing earlier wound up very much being that way. I mean, it wasn't the kind of thing I ever would have willingly walked into, you know. It was against every fiber of my being to have that experience. But having come out on the other end, you can fathom why it was important and how it shaped me in a positive way that otherwise wouldn't have happened. So yeah, just because you don't want it to happen doesn't mean it's not working out for you in some way.
Yeah. And I mean, also that one of the things I think that's astrology that's positive, that again, circles back to one of the earlier questions, is how does it influence your life? Is that I do think in some instances for astrologers that astrology, looking at other people's charts, can allow you to develop a great deal of empathy for other people. Because one of the things that you learn, and this is a realization I had a few years ago that Lisa sort of pointed out to me, which is just one of the things that's frustrating is sometimes if you're an external observer that's looking at somebody who's doing something or they're making a mistake or going down a difficult path, as an external observer, you can point to that and just say, you know, look at what you're doing. Like, this is obviously not a good idea. And this totally matches this thing that's happening in your chart right now. But if you're actually that person and you're doing that at the time, you know, sometimes I guess the life lesson, I guess, and maybe I can't articulate this properly right now, but it's just that you can't actually understand what it's like to have a certain placement and to do certain things unless you have that placement yourself. And when you're in that role, you know, your shortcomings are your shortcomings, and it's not something you can step outside of, but instead it's something that is just, you know, sort of inherent that you can't quite escape. You can try and work on it and stuff, but those are still going to be the things that are difficult or challenging for you, even if they're not challenging for other people. And that's the part that I think allows for a development of empathy, is that I don't think I'm articulating that right, but you know what I'm talking about, right, Lisa?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you articulated it pretty well. I think it's a matter of, you know, that we have to live our lives as ourselves and we're not interchangeable. Even if we all know astrology, we're still experiencing life through particular lenses. And I think a lot of it comes down to whether we're supposed to be kind of situated external to the astrology and to our lives even, and to kind of be looking in on it and trying to decide from a supposed objective standpoint, like what is best here, versus how much we're supposed to be, you know, living in that particular life, no matter, you know, the pieces that don't look so ideal. And maybe there's something purposeful about having those experiences, and maybe you're supposed to have those particular experiences, even if from an objective standpoint, that wouldn't be what someone would choose usually. So I think we're both articulated maybe imperfectly different pieces of it right now.
Yeah, I mean, and Patrick, I think before we started this recording, you were talking a little bit about that, because you're actually in the process of winding up your Saturn return right now. And so you've actually got a lot more perspective compared to when you went into it about obviously what it was going to be. It was a little bit like what you expected it to be about, but also a little different. But you sort of gained some perspective on it since then, right?
Yeah. I mean, I having started studying astrology since I was 14 or 15 or so around my Saturn opposition, you know, I was always kind of looking ahead to my Saturn return and seeing what had happened to other people with Saturn returns and kind of thinking, well, what the heck is mine going to be about? And, you know, at the Saturn, the next Saturn square to my natal Saturn, that was back in 2008, 2009. That's when I first started blogging in astrology. And so I suspected that perhaps, you know, my Saturn return would be about something to do with astrology. But as Saturn entered Sagittarius, I began blogging in earnest from my own side, and instead of taking astrology as a study and astrology as a profession more seriously. And so in that time, I worked on these articles, and I sort of building up a bit of a practice. And now I'm releasing my own astrology show. And so, yeah, I mean, this, it's all been about kind of taking myself a little more seriously, because I kind of like to make a joke out of myself. So, I mean, I still like to make a joke out of myself, but now I feel like I'm kind of more owning up to myself and who I am more than I did before.
Sure. And I mean, you anticipated some difficulties, and it's like you had some difficulties, but it was like,
yeah. I mean, the other thing about my Saturn transit is my Saturn is in my fifth. And so the ingress was with the birth of my third child. And that's pretty much when me and my wife decided, like, no more kids. You know, we both have Saturn in the fifth. So, yeah, like, you know, having three kids has almost broken us as people. And, you know, everything, I feel like that meme of the dog with the cup of coffee in, you know, the room engulfed by flames, and it's just sort of smiling thing, like, everything's fine, you know, like, that's kind of our life on a daily basis. But, yeah, with three kids. So, like, you know, having one was awesome. Having two was not quite so great, but, like, still pretty good. But three is just, like, you know, all bets are off. So, yeah, I mean, that's also been a really huge part of you know, my Saturn return is just, this is the hardest it will ever be, you know, with three children under 5 years old. And it's been much harder on my wife than it has been for me. But what I've learned from Saturn is, you know, having kids sucks, and that, you know, doing everything that you want to do is very, very difficult. And I also had, I have Saturn in a night chart. So I was always suspecting that around the election, for which I had made a prediction for a Hillary Clinton victory, which obviously didn't happen. And so I noticed that I was going to have this return, and Saturn in night chart is not supposed to be that great. So I thought, well, you know, I just tried to reason it away, you know, thinking, well, you know, maybe it's about something else. But no, it was about, you know, making this prediction and being wrong about it, and but still finding it somewhere in myself to you know, continue despite, you know, having a very embarrassing, misfire, you know, with my astrological prediction skills.
Sure. I mean, one of the things I like about both of those that's interesting is that you also have Saturn relatively closely conjunct Uranus. And so, so both of those two things that you just talked about were both sort of surprises or like unexpected twists.
Basically. Right. Yeah, my Saturn
planning to have like a third child.
Yeah,
right?
We weren't really planning for the third. Saturn is since my Saturn is loosely conjunct Uranus, it kind of takes on its own Uranus type flavor. And of course, I was very very shocked when I was wrong about the election as well. And many of us were. I'm sure that everyone has their own ways in which they understand that event.
We'll all be recounting it
Ever. what was the next question?
moving on.
Yikes.
No, we should actually move on. So, that was fun though. We should do this more often. Actually, I think I want to make this cause we're basically just using some of these questions as jumping off points for like a round table discussion amongst astrologers. And that's actually a much more interesting format that I've been wanting to move more towards for some episodes. So I think we can try to get through a few more, but, I like the sort of free flow of this discussion. So we'll try to do a few more, but then otherwise not push it too much further and maybe come back and do this again sometime before too long.
Sounds good.
Okay. So let me see what other, there's a few other house division questions. I don't want to get too bogged down in that because it's such a complicated and touchy issue. And I feel like I've come back to it so many times over the past year. But I'll save that for another episode. So let's see. There was a question from Barbara about secondary progressions. Daniel Larkin had a pretty good question about straightforward question about conjunction. So he says, how do you approach interpreting the conjunction between a malefic and a benefic? Does it make the benefic weaker? Does it make the malefic less menacing, or both or neither? This isn't a new question between us, but I think it's a good one for the community to ponder.
Well, it's isn't that basically asking how to approach a Venus-Saturn conjunction or a Mars-Jupiter conjunction?
Or a few different combinations.
Right, I guess there's a few different combinations that would apply. I mean, I think that how does Richard Tarnas describe it? He says that, there's often, basically it goes both ways. I mean, whatever the malefic signifies, a benefic can help, but whatever the benefic signifies, the malefic hurts. There's always sort of a two-way street, in the way which it works.
Well, if I may jump in, when you have two planets in conjunction, they really take on each other's significations. They're joined at the hip. For someone who's got a Saturn Venus conjunction, those two planets Saturn will always take on a sort of Venus quality in its transits, and Venus will always take on a Saturn quality in its transits. It's very much they wind up sort of like Watson's saying, you get this double-edged sword where the both planets are mitigated, and obviously in the case of the benefic, to have it mitigated by a malefic isn't such a great thing, but to have a malefic mitigated by a benefic can be quite a saving grace. And then it just comes down to which one of those two planets in the conjunction rules an angle, or rules the sectlight, or just has that much more power in the chart. If you've got Venus conjunct Saturn, but you're Aquarius or Capricorn rising, that can be quite a great thing. But if you have Venus conjunct Saturn and you're a Libra, a Taurus rising, well, maybe more a Taurus rising, it can be a tough thing. It all comes down in the end, as it always does, to the individual chart.
There's that example of, remember back, I think it was in May of, it was like late April or, May, or early May of 2011 when Osama bin Laden was killed. There was a Mars-Jupiter conjunction, and so clearly, you know, the people were celebrating the, you know, his assassination. So there was kind of, you know, that's sort of Jupiter, like cheering on Mars, Jupiter kind of making Mars like, you know, this good guy, you know, because we got this really bad guy, you know. And then obviously the Mars Jupiter conjunction couldn't have been good for Osama bin Laden, who, you know, got killed. So, always kind of a two way, street with any conjunction like that.
Yeah, so I often see it show up the most if you look at which planets of those two together are ruling which houses of the chart. So say Saturn is ruling a couple houses in a night chart, and so those house topics would work out not so great ordinarily. And say Venus in the same night chart is aspecting that Saturn. And so then the Venus would be making that Saturn a little bit better than it otherwise would be. And therefore, those two housed, the themes associated with those two houses that Saturn rules would be kind of brought up a little bit. But then conversely, say Venus is ruling a couple houses in the chart, and that same Saturn in a night chart is aspecting that. And so therefore, the houses that Venus rules that would otherwise be really good in a night chart would be brought down some by the Saturn aspect. So I see it working together, but that's kind of a way you can differentiate a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
That's helpful.
And the only other thing I'd say about that is two things. One, sect is really useful when it comes to interpreting and differentiating those, because if the benefic is of the sect in favor, so if it's a day chart, if it's Jupiter in a day chart or, let's say, Venus in a night chart, and it's conjunct a malefic that's not that malefic due to sect, then the benefic's going to win out. Whereas if the malefic is contrary to the sect, like Saturn in a night chart or Mars in a day chart, then typically the malefic is going to win out. So there's different combinations of those that can be better or worse. And then it also matters whether which planet is applying to the other. But that's a whole other thing. So there's a few different considerations you can take into account, but sect is a big one. Reception is also another big one, where even a difficult conjunction between two planets, if one of them is in the domicile of the other, then that's going to take the edge off of that conjunction, and it's going to make it more constructive pretty much no matter what. So there's a few different ways you can interpret that, or different technical things you can take into account. But that both of that is true, in that there's different technical things. And then the other thing that everybody else is emphasizing is true, that sometimes you just get both, or sometimes they do balance each other out.
Hmm.
All right. So that's a good question. Let's do one more. And then I think we're at like an hour and 45 or something, which is a pretty relatively long, decent sized episode. Are there any other questions that you guys are seeing that you that stand out to you, or that you guys wanted to do before we ended?
Should I tackle the question about exterior and interior conjunctions and synodic cycles?
Right. So it's from listener Belinda Tomlinson, who says, one question I have for your 100th episode is further discussion on the inferior and superior conjunctions as it relates to a synodic cycle and the difference in interpretation.
Yeah. And this is, it's a great question, and it's one I'm continuing to ask myself. There's definitely a link between the two, but I don't see an interpretive difference as of yet, because I see very often very similar types of events occurring at either one of those points, either one of those conjunctions. They tend to be linked thematically. Like, for instance, this retrograde going on now, this Venus retrograde we have in Aries, you'll often, if you look into your own life or the life of your client, you can see certain ways that it ties into things that were going on 4 years ago when there was an exterior conjunction with the Sun and Venus in Aries. Because they alternate every 4 years, you get an exterior and inferior in the same sign, and pretty much at the same degree, you get those conjunctions. So they're linked thematically, but you can never tell. The thing about these cycles is, in themselves, they don't indicate a sort of, you know, positive or negative outcome with regard to any situation. That'll be mitigated to whatever else the however else the conjunction is configured with other planets in the chart, or in the transits rather. I know it's an ambiguous answer, and the only thing I can really say, really having looked at this closely in a lot of instances, is they're linked, but I wouldn't make too much of interpreting them differently from each other. That comes down to whatever else is going on in the sky and not from the conjunction itself.
Although
I hope that helps.
Although wouldn't you say that the inferior conjunction, since that's when the interior planets are retrograde, that those tend to kind of stand out more since they're retrograde?
No.
No. All right.
No. No, I don't. No. No. I've been putting together a bunch of pieces on historical examples of these conjunctions, and I see over and over that the exterior conjunctions, the ones that happen when the planet isn't retrograde, can very much reflect the same type of thing that you associate with the retrograde. And that what it really comes down to is it's about the interaction of, in this case, Venus and the Sun, and not just a matter of Venus being, going backwards in motion or appearing to go backwards in motion. I think the one distinction I'll make is that the exterior conjunctions come and go a lot faster, whereas the retrogrades, because Venus stays in the same part of the sky over a month, that period sort of stretches out more. So in terms of looking at timing, there's a difference, but not in interpretation.
Okay. And I remember, I wish I could remember it more clearly. I think it was Adam Gainsburg said in his lecture that he wanted to like rename superior and inferior because people always got them confused, or it was kind of hard because it didn't usually, correctly convey what the actual observational difference is, where one of them is closer on, where we can see it, so that it's the planet covering or going across the face of the sun, whereas the other one is the planet going on the other side of the sun, at least with inner planets.
Closer and further, inny and outy.
It was something like that. I can't remember.
Well, that's just it. It's just astronomically slightly more accurate, somewhat more accurate, to refer to them as exterior and interior conjunctions rather than superior and inferior. And that's really the reason I use the terminologies I do. There's a few people who've pointed this out. Adam is one of them. Adam Gainsburg is one of them. Gemini Brett, who's an astrologer out in the West Coast of the States, is another one to have pointed it out. So I appreciate the logic of that. And so I've made a conscious effort to refer to them as exterior and interior rather than superior and inferior. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, exterior/superior, meaning the sun is conjunct Venus or Mercury, when those planets are not retrograde, and interior or inferior, is when those planets make a conjunction to the sun while retrograde. In other words, moving from evening star back into morning star position.
And that's just referring to the inner planets, or?
Well, yeah, because it can only be Mercury or Venus. Mars can never make an interior conjunction to the sun, because when Mars is retrograde, it's opposite the sun, as are all the planets following it. So it's only Mercury and Venus.
Right. I just wanted to make sure sort of listeners are clear, because it's a little like complicated when you're first hearing it and you can't really like visualize what's going on. But it's just the difference where, sometimes a planet will pass between the Earth and the sun so that the planet like passes over the face of the sun. And other times The planet will pass behind the sun from our perspective on Earth, so that you can't see it, but it's otherwise conjunct the sun.
That's right. And it's when the planet is retrograde that it's between Earth and the sun. And it's when that's the irony, is retrograde planets, retrogrades occur when the planet is closest to Earth. And the conjunction to the sun generally means it's on the other side of the sun.
Right.
And it's furthest,
Yeah, and I'm sure there ultimately are.
Hence the interior and exterior distinction.
Right. And I'm sure there certainly are all sorts of possible distinctions or subtle distinctions between a lot of these things. There's just so much of this, you know, all of it ultimately is so complicated that each astrologer can only do so much or sometimes follows certain lines of research, but there's always going to be other lines of research that are sort of left for somebody else to do or somebody else to figure out. And oftentimes there is somebody else working on it, but you're not aware of the research that they've done. And yeah, it's a pretty broad field, and there's always still a lot more to research.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done a lot of my own work on the subject for a long time, but I am now sort of looking out at what other people have been doing. I deliberately sort of shut myself in blinders for a while and just focused on my little thread of things. But now I'm sort of connecting what I'm doing with what other people are doing with some pretty fruitful results. And I'm about to start posting a bunch of stuff pertaining to this very question. So check out my website, nickdaganbest.com, for future word on the subject.
Awesome. Great. And of course, we're in the middle or in the early stages of Venus retrograde, and people can listen to the past Venus retrograde episode that you and I did, I think like a year and a half ago, for a really good sort of treatment of that that's still applicable to this one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think we should probably, even though we've gotten through actually very few questions, unfortunately, we should probably wrap this up because it's already like 1:30 in the morning here for half of us, for 3/4 of us. And and thank you guys for joining me for this momentous occasion with the 100th episode.
Happy 100.
Well, thank you, Chris. Yeah, happy 100. Let's please try this again. And, you know, normally my situation won't be as chaotic as this. It was a last minute fix.
Yeah. We're definitely going to do this again. I want to get to a lot of these other questions and maybe even revisit some of them that we did or like touched on, but didn't do as thoroughly as we could. And I think this will give us a lot of material for future episodes. So let's definitely plan on reconvening before too long and doing this again soon.
Excellent.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us. Thanks for listening to the 100th episode. And here's to 100 more episodes. And we'll see how long that takes and then check in again 100 episodes later and see what the podcast looks like then. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Awesome.